Well, about 30 people showed up for last night's first public hearing on the $56 million school bond. Only about eight spoke. Joining me now in the studio, I have two Park City School Board members, President Tanya Knauer and Julie Eihausen. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's make it very clear to our listeners. The school board has decided that if the community votes the bond down, then next year the school board will raise the capital levy to 100% of its authorization? Is that?
No, that's not correct.
No, even if we do go with the financing option of raising the levy, we still will not be maxing out our ability to tax via that vehicle, I guess I should say. Basically, here's what the facts are. We are at capacity and over capacity at our elementary schools, so we need to get a grade off that campus. We have a building that houses two grades that is beyond its useful life. So we have to find a relocation for three grades. That's between 1,000 and 1,200 students. We have to house them either in buildings or we have to house them in trailers. We have to house them somewhere. So we're building a 5-6 to put the fifth graders at Ecker. 7-8 is going to be relocating the eighth grade. And ninth grade is going to get relocated to the high school.
All right, so let's talk to us, though, about, because what we're hearing is that people either approve the bond, which will be less money in the long run, or the school board will raise taxes through the capital mill levy.
So the high school was actually built with a capital levy, and that levy is given, the school board has authority over that levy for when it needs to do some capital expenditures. It has always been our desire to give the voters the ability to decide, to make the decision first. When we put together our bond financing committee, their recommendation was the most affordable thing for voters, taxpayers, is to do a bond over 20 years because we have favorable rates, we don't have any debt right now, and it's a great opportunity. If the voters decide not to pass that bond, then we obviously will need to regroup and we would need to decide how much we need to take out in a capital levy and when we would need to take it out, over how many years. And honestly, we haven't gotten to that rate. I mean, we can tell you that it would be in the neighborhood of $300 to $500 a year, depending again on how much we take out and over what time period. This is why we've made the choice of doing the bond, giving the voters the option of the bond, because that would be $123 or whatever it is a year.
Well, and also with the levy, if we do go the levy route versus the bond, the funds are not available to us immediately, which we really, I mean, the buildings need to be built. So if we go the levy route, we have to wait until we collect the money. So we have potentially higher building costs, and we don't have the time to wait for that. With the bond, we can draw the money as we need it, get our facilities built, and get our kids into buildings.
All right. But I just, to throw those numbers out, because I hadn't heard numbers until somebody last night mentioned, you know, we're talking about, you know, for the average house, $639,000, $10.27 or something a month, as opposed to $46.54 a month. Where did that number come from?
You know, I don't really know where that number came from. I mean, I think it sort of depends on what your assumptions are when you're calculating numbers. That could have been the full $56 million. You know, in a 3-year period, in a 2-year period. I'm not really quite sure. Again, people are making their own assumptions out there, and we haven't posted any numbers on what that would be, because there's so many variables in terms of the years that you're looking at and how much you want to take out.
So how long would you take money out through the capital levy if that's the route you decide? I mean, you wouldn't have $56 million in 1 year. It would take several years to raise $56 million, right? Because you would put it into the capital fund and let it sit until you had the money.
Well, we would take out the money as we needed the money. And so a lot of that is going to depend on our building schedules and when we need to start paying and putting together a costing structure of when we owe what. So that it's more complicated than that. And that's why I'm giving you a range that if we go the capital levy route, then it's probably in the neighborhood of $300 to $500 per year. depending on a lot of variables.
Again, but that still doesn't give you the $56 million
in one year. No, but it would give us enough.
No, not 1 year.
No, but we would have enough in utilizing our capital fund, we would be able to at least get started.
I mean, this is a 2 to 3 year building process in terms of bringing in the architects and putting together the design and putting together the construction schedule. And the it's not going to be happening in 1 year. It's going to be happening over the course of 2 to 3 years.
All right. But again, those two choices, bond or capital levy, I mean, that's what people are saying. That's the definition of bully, insisting on doing things your way in spite of what other people think. Again, you're giving people the opportunity to vote on this. If they turn you down, you're doing it your way anyway.
No, it's not like that. We have to house, we have to relocate 1,000 to 1,200 students. How we do that, we have to determine that. The master planning committee got together and said, this is the way that we think this should be. We have to replace Treasure Mountain. We still have a contingency of people who say Treasure Mountain's perfectly fine. Put a new coat of paint on it and slap some new carpet down. I'm sorry, Treasure Mountain is not perfectly fine. We have to replace that school. And that is, it's about a $25 million expense. There's no way around that. We are at capacity. We have to do something to house our students. The option that we're dealing with right now is trailers. And that's our option, buildings for kids or trailers for kids.
The high school was built with a capital levy. And I mean, the whole reason that the school district or the school board has access to those levies is so they can finance things that they need, be they buildings or whatever. And that's the whole purpose. It's not bullying. It's using taxpayer dollars to do what needs to be done in your community, to invest in the education of your children.
Yeah. And you both certainly know this, that it's not facilities that determines the success of our students or our athletes. I mean, greatness comes from paying teachers well, having small class sizes, getting parents involved. There's people who say you can teach in a barn. So when we talk about whether or not we have facilities for our children or in trailers, some people are even saying, well, trailers maybe not such a bad idea, because then that keeps the out-of-district students from coming in who don't pay their fair share to be educated.
So when we were looking at master planning, that was part of the reason we didn't just toss another elementary school out there, is because then we would have excess capacity. So when we are looking at capacity, we're looking at dealing with capacity at K through 12, because our secondary schools are also at capacity. I mean, the high school is at 102%. So we need to be addressing capacity needs throughout the entire grades. So no, we don't want our kids. I mean, we live in Park City. Is that the quality that we want, is putting our kids in trailers? I don't know. I mean, we all consider this a world-class town with world-class athletes, with world-class schools. And so what we're looking at here are updating some of our facilities that are 20 to 30 years old. And, you know, I would invite anybody who is questioning the performing arts and athletics, that remodel that's happening at the back of the high school, to take a tour for themselves. I mean, we'd be more than happy to give them one, because I actually hadn't seen one myself. And walking through there, and I got a kid in the school, I was actually shocked at how outdated some of our facilities were. And I think we've told you, we took a tour of some other school districts that are much smaller than us and certainly don't have anywhere near the capacity to raise funds that we do, and they were very nice. Now, it just depends on what we want. I mean, I think we have a board that thinks that we need to have, I don't even want to say decent.
Well, facilities for our kids. Everything that is on our plan, everything that this bond is going to fund, is driven by capacity. We are at capacity. Safety and compliance. Every single thing. And we were asked by the community to go to bare bones. We have gone to bare bones, and yet we still are hearing that we're going the luxurious route. We have to have facilities for our students. I know facilities do not educate our students. However, we do need to provide adequate facilities.
Yeah, and I think that's really where a sticking point is that certainly there are supporters for providing new classrooms, and, you know, so kids aren't in trailers. But at the same time, now we're talking about another $12 million for a field house that people think, you know, is that really necessary? I mean, what does that got to do with capacity and safety?
Okay, I will tell you, as we, the high school was currently designed for somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 students. As we bring in the ninth graders and that high school continues to grow, we're going to be at 1,600. And within 5 years, we might be at 1,800 or so kids at that school. That school does not have the performing arts nor the athletic facilities to hold that many kids. And as far as a field house goes, we heard from so many parents. I mean, we have 2,000 kids in our school district that participate in some sort of sport. Field sport, I should say. Not even all the snow sports, but a field sport. And we heard loud and clear from those parents that they feel that we need a field house. Now, I also want to say that when we were going to the other places, Bear River and Morgan, those field houses are used all day long by PE. There's PE classrooms and CTE classrooms in there. There's storage in there. So we know, just based on our discussions with other school districts, that that will be used from the time it opens until the evening.
Yeah. I've just recently have heard concerns about the athletic facilities being for boys only, because we're talking about Dozier Field, and that is used for football only.
Okay, no, let's clear something up. Dozier Field is a sports field. It's not a football field. And whether you like football or not, that's a whole separate conversation. But every high school needs a sports field. Football plays on there, soccer, girls and boys, plays on there, lacrosse, girls and boys play on there. It's a field for anything. We also have graduation there and other events there. I mean, currently there's track events that happen there. So it is an all sports field.
And it is for both sexes to play sports on. Currently, our girls' soccer practices on the North 40, but that is an option that their coach has made, or a choice their coach has made, because she prefers them to play on the grass. If we had to try to schedule girls' soccer on our current existing single turfed field, we've run out of time already. So we need to have additional fields. We need to have additional turf fields. We need to provide the facilities again for all of our student athletes.
Let's talk about the cost. They seem to have taken a huge dive from what was being discussed during the master planning process. I mean, field houses ranging from $15 to $17 million. Now we're down to 12. Dozier Field costing $8 million to move and rebuild. Now we're down less than $4 million. Originally, what was totaled as like $26 million for these facilities, now down to 12. So what numbers are right? The ones that
we're hearing? When you're getting costing numbers, and you can cost anything from a tent to a castle. So when the cost folks were putting numbers together, I think the field house numbers they were putting together were for like a structure similar to what you see out at the basin. And I don't know how much that one cost, but I have a feeling it's probably more in the $15 to $20 million range would be my guess. But the ones that we saw, for example, in Bear River and Morgan, those were all somewhere around the $5 million range. It really depends on the roofing. I mean, we have to look at all the stuff. So I think they were presenting us with the most expensive option, which that's not what we're going to do. I mean, that type of field house is something Basin Rec can build, and they can build it out at 40 if they want to. But we're looking at something a little bit more simple that meets our needs.
All right, you met Carter Livingston. He's the person, I think, from Strategies 360 who's going to help develop the bond pamphlet. So what happens there? I mean, does it include both the for and against the bond?
So the for and against was what you'll see when you open up your ballot. And we provided a paragraph about the bond, and I think that is considered the for. The against would have to be put together by some against group if that's what they wanted to do. And I don't believe anybody stepped up to that. The next thing we're putting together is a voter pamphlet. And that, I don't even think that has a for and against in it, actually. I think that's really mostly just facts about the bond. You know, these are the projects. This is how much it's going to cost. This is why we're doing it. This is the process. That type of stuff. So he's helping us put together that information, as well as we've had a lot of input from the community that they need to know more about this. And so we are putting together also some information pamphlets for the community. So he's kind of helping us tie a red ribbon around our communications, because honestly, we're not communications experts, and neither is anyone in our district office.
Yeah. I got to ask you, since there is not any against the bond as part of the school district's website, and we've heard that is because the district didn't get any information by the September 14th deadline. Did you know about the September 14th deadline?
Well, we did, because we had to give information. Again, the for and against doesn't go to us. It goes to the county clerk. So, I mean, that would be...
That's their deadline.
That's their responsibility if there is a group out there to meet that deadline.
And we did post the information that had the deadlines that was posted on our website. So it's not like we were trying to hide the information. It's just that's a deadline that's set by the county. Actually, it's set by the state. And we provided the for response. That is what we're required to do by law.
Yeah. Did you see where it was posted on the website?
Yeah, it's in the bond information.
No, it's not in the bond information.
It's the second tab in the bond information. You click on the tab that says bond info.
If it got changed in the last day, it does, but it didn't earlier on Monday.
So I don't know that that's our responsibility, actually, again, to be knocking on doors and saying, hey, do you have an against? Go ahead and, I mean, you know what I'm saying? That's if there is a group out there that is against this, it's their responsibility to figure out how to get their argument out to the clerk.
I'm just asking if you knew, because if you knew, it would have been nice for other people to have known. If you want to get, you know, if you have something
okay,
to
so
say.
Todd did mention it. It was discussed in board meetings.
It was discussed in multiple board meetings because it was our first deadline. And we had to actually scramble because we were surprised. So we knew about it and we discussed it at multiple board meetings.
All right. Let's talk briefly about the grade realignment. You went ahead and approved that you're going to push it back a year, except for full-day kindergarten?
That's correct. I think the goal with the whole thing is what we're looking at over the next 2 years are a lot of changes. And the more that we can make it simple and not make a lot of changes next year, and really wait for all of our buildings to be ready, I think it's easier for kids. I think it's easier for families. It also gives our staff a lot of planning time because we are going to be looking at start times. We're going to be looking at schedules.
You wouldn't have anywhere to move them anyway, though, would you?
We've always got the trailer option.
Yeah. I mean, there are ways we could move kids around. But to us, I think it just seems the more that we keep it the same next year, the easier it is for everybody.
All right. So where are you going to put the kindergartners full day then?
So what we've heard is that Parley's and Trailside are the two schools that we're going to have to get a little creative with. We might have to have some more trailers. You know, the principals are really going to have to look at their space and figure out what they can do. Supposedly at McPollin and Jeremy, they have a way to squish things in. I mean, it's going to be challenging for a year.
All right. And finally, there was a request from the band teacher about funding a trip to Hawaii to be participate in the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, it's exciting.
So did you approve that? Or
we discussed it, and we are going to... it's on our agenda to approve next time. The funds, you know, it's a fairly expensive trip. It's like $2,000 per kid. I think that's what I saw. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be doing a lot of fundraising. And it is December of 2016, so they do have some time to prepare. The Red Apple... not the Red Apple Gala, the other...
The Sweetheart Gala.
I mean, they've been doing a lot of great fundraising, so I'm confident that they'll be able to raise that money.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
We have another bond hearing on October 20th, if anybody is interested in coming to that. And I do know there's questions out there about lots of different things, so people are free to email anybody on the board or our superintendent at any time.
All right. Tanya Knauer, Julie Eihausen, thanks.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:36. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour. I'm KPCW. Joining me now in the studio, Park City Manager Diane Foster, along with our budget manager, Nate Rotler. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
So rather short agenda tomorrow. Work session starts at 3:50. At 4 o'clock, an update from the U.S. EPA on the Uinta Mining District site work plan and schedule. This was like new to me. Where's the Uinta Mining District?
Uinta Mining District, and how did they name it? I think that's a great question. Marty McComb, who is from EPA Region 8, which is in Denver, and he's been working with us over the past few years. He's going to be here to talk about this specifically. The Uinta Mining District is the upper watershed here. So it's up in Empire Pass, up in the, it's kind of Deer Valley and Park City Mountain Resort, those upper areas. And the EPA had identified what they call innovative assessment sites. So it's basically a lot of the mine source areas and places where there were piles of tailings. And a few years ago, the city requested that the EPA go back in and look at those innovative assessment sites because they were simply identified as, hey, these are sites we should look at, but they hadn't actually taken that next step to look at them. And the EPA, I believe it was last week or the week before, EPA and United Park City Mines, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Talisker, signed an administrative order on consent. So United Park City Mines and Talisker have said we'll take ownership for that, and EPA in the administrative order on consent goes ahead and says this is how you need to remediate these sites and this is what you need to do.
Yeah. Is there like a price tag on it in terms of what needs to happen?
I don't, you know, I haven't read the AOC and our attorneys have been through it. I don't believe that it gives a specific price, but it does identify specific actions that need to take place. And, you know, administrative order on consent is what the EPA, what United Park City Mines and Talisker have signed for Lower Silver Creek cleanup, and that is in process now. And it's also something that the city has signed with the EPA on the Prospector Drain, and we're working on that. So they're very strong agreements with the EPA. Administrative order on consent, it's basically like they're telling you what to do and you agree to do it.
And so there's also a schedule laid out. So when is this all going to be finished by?
I haven't seen the schedule. Actually, I don't think the schedule is defined in the AOC, but it does. Actually, part of the reason why Marty is coming to do this update tomorrow is specifically because there are going to be some EPA is going to be in town and is actually starting work up there. And so wanted to let the community know, hey, if you see an EPA truck, this is what's happening.
So EPA and Talisker are picking up the cost?
I believe EPA is providing support, but United Park City Mines and Talisker should be picking up the cost.
All right. Not knowing what we about the future of Talisker, I mean, is it empty pockets or?
You know, that's been a question that the city and county have, as you know, both the city and county, we met with the EPA Region 8, and we met with the most senior person there who in Region 8 that we can meet with. We can't meet with the regional administrator because we hired him as a consultant in the past before he worked for the EPA. So we've asked that question very much, and EPA is well aware of the financial situation and is doing, looking at the tools and evaluating the tools that they have to be able to hold them accountable.
Well, I guess more importantly, are Park City taxpayers on the line for any of this?
Park City taxpayers are not involved in this. The city government is not involved in this. We were not a party to this agreement. We're not a signatory. And EPA made us aware of this about a month ago that they were working on it. And specifically, the city's role is the city council had asked the EPA to go ahead and look at these sites because the city council is very much of the opinion that they want residents protected in the watershed.
All right. Also spending about a half hour reviewing the Open and Public Meetings Act for the state of Utah. Is this in response to anything that may have
This is actually a required annual training for public officials. So Polly Samuels-McLean, our assistant city attorney, will be doing that. And I was pretty excited yesterday. I actually got an email from a member of the public asking if they could attend. And so it is an open training, so people can come and listen to it. And it was pretty fun last year.
So, I mean, let's define real quickly what a meeting is and what it isn't. You know, when you see more than a quorum of city council members having coffee at JavaCow, is that a meeting?
Utah state law says that two council members can get together and talk about city business, so they can do that. What can't happen is that three or more can't get together and talk about city business. So they can get together and talk about city business if it's a noticed meeting. And so, for example, on City Tour, we had the mayor and three city council members. They weren't specifically there to discuss city business, but we did notice it just so the public knew that the city council would be on that. We do the same thing for dinners, even though we're careful, and the city council is actually very careful not to discuss city business. You'll notice that city council always, at the end of their meetings, sometimes they go out afterwards and they always announce we will not be discussing city business, but we will invite the public to go with us because a majority of city council might be there, so we notice that. And there's always a staff member who attends as well, Mark Harrington. Has established a protocol that we're careful about that, and our city council very much believes in it.
All right. Let's see. Bring Nate into the conversation. There'll be another half-hour discussion with an update on potential and future historic preservation funding options. And this is what, a dedicated line item to save old mining relics and buildings?
Yeah. You know, a month or so ago, the planning department came back and outlined a bunch of tools that were available for doing historic preservation and related to Main Street, the historic downtown, but also the mine sites. On that list of tools, one of them was trying to get historic easements granted to the city, and so part of that may require some funding for that program. And so really we're just kind of outlying the funding side of that, and as we continue to develop what the program side of that will be. So it'll be a new program in the budget.
All right. We've just approved a budget, so it wouldn't go into effect until the 20 fiscal 16-17 budget?
Yeah, that would be the idea behind that.
Yeah, how much are we talking about?
We're not sure. You know, the planning department is working to develop that, or to continue to get things on that historic sites inventory list and evaluate all these different structures and try to figure out, you know, what level do you want to restore these or preserve these, and what the different costs and the different timing would be on that. So we don't have a firm number yet on what that might be.
Yeah. Any idea how much we're setting aside now? I mean, through maybe the historic preservation grants or things like that?
Through the historic preservation grants, we, through a combination of funds, have, you know, close to, I believe, $90,000 there per year on an annual amount. And that's another area where, as that program gets developed and we feel more confident that we're getting the results out of that program that we want to see in terms of historic preservation, that might be something that we recommend council might move up some of those funding amounts as well. So,
I think Vail Resorts was responsible, what, for putting together an inventory, at least on their property, of any mining relics?
They have. They've completed, this was the conditional use permit that was issued for the gondola and the snow hut, and that required that they complete the resort complete an inventory of mining sites, historic mining sites. They've completed that. They hired an outside group to do that, and also required that they spend $50,000 on historic preservation of mining sites. The Park City Historical Society requested of the resort that they spend that on shoring up California Comstock. The city has sent, the city and the resort agreed that that would comply with the conditional use permit. And I talked to Sandra Morrison yesterday, and she said they were just working on an agreement, on the access agreement for, excuse me, to go up to California Comstock to do the work, and that she does have a number of other funders who have participated in that. But that all being said, I'm sure Sandra, I would be remiss if I said that Sandra has enough money to do all the work she wants to do. So if people are interested in providing funding for historic preservation, as well as on the Daly Mine Shaft, the city is still working on that. Assistant City Manager Matt Dias is heading up that effort. And as of yet, we don't have anyone else besides the city who stepped up and said that they want to help fund the restoration of that.
Okay. So any guess, I mean, how much the city would be spending on this?
On the Daly, on the headframe?
For as you look at the budget next year.
That's not clear, and that's why we're having this discussion today, is to provide council that opportunity to say, we want you in the next year's budget to look at possibly making changes.
Okay, finally, just wanted to mention that the council will discuss what Council Member Tim Henney thinks should be moved up to a critical priority to add to housing and transportation, and that would be to discuss the environmental impacts and the carbon output. I think the executive staff says, well, let's wait until next budget year, and the sustainability department saying we need to do it ASAP.
Yeah, it's actually a split recommendation, which is not a bad thing to have from staff. My perspective on this is that City Council can direct us to say, hey, look, we want to look at environmental sustainability and specifically carbon reduction as a critical priority now. Go ahead and do all the work, and then we'll fund it in the budget process. The environmental sustainability staff says it needs to happen now, and that provides a good basis for council discussion.
Okay. Anything else?
Let's see. We've got I do want to congratulate the folks who've worked on safety at the city. We've got several awards that are in a manager's report, including one on creating workplace safety and for the AED program. There are now 4 public AEDs around, and also there are AEDs in the sergeant's cars for the police. They're at the MARC. They're in City Hall. So it's a good safety piece, and congratulations to Hugh Daniels and all the safety committee.
Okay. Diane, Nate, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
KBCW News Time now, 8:48. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. In the studio with me now, Bea Peck, a member of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. Good morning, Bea.
Good morning.
So the formal agenda quickly approved by the Planning Commission. Why do you think the Snyderville Code, though, need to be rewritten and improved concerning renovation of the historic district structures?
There are a few parcels, not many, in the county that we just felt were potentially targets, and I don't mean that in a bad way, to renovate or upgrade, and we did want to protect obvious historic features to them. So we felt we needed to beef up our code. We don't have the same issues that Park City, Old Town have, but just for the few structures that we have, we felt it was just to do even the minimal that we did was necessary.
Okay, really the beef of the meeting came with the joint meeting with Park City Planning Commission, talking about affordable housing and traffic. I mean, both common problems, as was mentioned. I mean, people don't see a boundary between Park City and Snyderville Basin. It's just really just a community. So given, though, that we have 2 planning jurisdictions that deal with them, I mean, how can you guys work together?
The meeting was great. I think to all of us, it just is common sense that we complement one another, that we work in sync with one another, because, as you say, we really are part of the larger community. So it makes no sense to have Park City Planning working on certain ordinances in terms of transportation or affordable or employee housing, and then we have a set of rules that perhaps are either contradictory or so. We've been talking about it a long time. It was great to finally do it. We're all committed to it, and we're going to try to meet as often as possible. Right now it'll be quarterly, and I think each meeting that comes up after this will start targeting specific topics so that they will be focused.
So does it mean having to go back and rewrite, though, each of the development codes so that they do kind of mesh?
Well, as you know, Snyderville Basin, we are in the process of rewriting our development code. So this is really perfect timing, because in order to get input from Park City to see what they've done to handle certain problems while we are rewriting our code, I think is going to be a tremendous advantage for us. And I don't know that Park City needs to rewrite theirs, but I think that as long as we're exposing areas of commonality and changes need to be made, this is going to be a great opportunity.
So let's talk briefly transportation. Did you hear any good ideas come out from the meeting in terms of just how we get people out of their cars?
It's such a thorny problem. We did talk a lot about trying to get people out of their cars. Let's focus on the resort community or visitors, even starting at the airport. What's the incentive or amenities that the resorts, the county, the cities can offer to get people out of their cars at the airport and get them up here so that they can enjoy their vacation, and whether that includes, you know, services to get them to be able to shop and get their skis up here. So we talked about a lot of that. We talked about the fact that 62% of the transportation issues are us. And so How do we get people out of their cars? And some of that was pretty interesting in terms of Colin DeFord on our commission talked about the technology maybe one of the things that can be used. People check in with each other if they each need a ride to the grocery store together, carpool that way. And at the same time, just adding more buses or trains or more traditional methods of alleviating traffic probably is not the solution, or at least the sole solution. So we've got to double track and take advantage of what technology we can. In the meantime, try to do the things like bike share. I know New Park, when we talked about Canyon Corners, we talked about doing a some sort of shuttle or trolley around New Park that might include the outlets. And again, if you park in one place, you don't have to keep driving to five different spots. Maybe you just go to one spot and then, you know, take a route.
Quickly about affordable housing, how do we do what we did with Canyon Corners with other projects? I mean, what we saw, part of the development is affordable housing right there.
Yeah, and I think the crux to that is that when a project comes in, affordable housing is a requirement for everyone that I can think of. The newest pressure or leverage that we have, and I'll use that word, is the timing of when the housing has to be built. And we are of one mind with Park City that sooner is better. And I think we just have to probably be very vigilant about this and make it a priority. And I'll say that most developers we've now encountered in the basin, as long as I've now been on the board, have been very cooperative about it. And when we've asked them to do it ahead of time, we haven't really run into resistance. I commend them for that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, kind of like with transportation where the enemy is us. I mean, the same thing with affordable housing, because
Absolutely.
Folks don't want it in their backyard, huh?
Well, what's it? I mean, there's, you know, I asked the question last night, employee housing, workforce housing, affordable housing, what do we perceive the differences to be? Affordable housing is considered to be 50% of median. Well, in this community, median is quite high. And so, you know, that's not a necessarily an hourly wage earner applying for affordable housing. It could be salaried employees looking for affordable housing.
But there's been talk about changing that in the code so that it's really more reflective of workforce housing as opposed to trying to get a median from where billionaires live.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I've struggled with some of that. I know when Silver Creek came in, we talked about that quite a bit. So we've got a lot of work ahead of us. It's if we're going to rely on, which we do, hourly wages, we've got to figure out a way for employers to provide employee housing, depending on who those employers are, usually the larger employers. That should be our focus.
So by meeting more often, you try and come up with some kind of priority list then to tackle?
I think the priorities will be just what we've talked about, transportation and employee housing, workforce housing. But each meeting we have, we're going to do it'll be focused. We'll have an agenda specific, bring in who we need to hear from, and try to at least get to some decision making.
All right. I need to leave it there. Bea, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Member of the Snyderville Planning Commission, Bea Peck. Well, the steepest 400-meter race in the world makes its U.S. debut right here in Park City on Saturday. In the studio with details, I have Alan Almorn. He is with the Park City Nordic Ski Club. Good morning.
Good morning.
So Red Bull 400, I didn't know what the heck that is. Tell us what it is.
Yeah. So Red Bull 400 started in 2011 in Kulm, Austria. A guy by the name of Andreas thought of it. He was a runner in his past, and he wanted to challenge runners with something out of the ordinary from the traditional 400-meter round of track. So he thought, why not use a ski jump? So there's a lot of ski jumps around Europe, and they started there in Kulm, Austria, which is a ski flying hill, which is double the size of a normal or the large Olympic hill. So they started running up it, and it's become quite a challenging event, but also attracts a special kind of runner. So we're really excited about it.
Yeah. So what usually just takes less a minute or so to run around the track now takes how long to run up straight uphill?
From what I understand, up in Whistler here a few weeks ago, they held one, and there was a gentleman that ran it under 4 minutes. I want to say it was 3 minutes and 58 seconds, which is phenomenal. So Now, that said, Whistler's at sea level, and most of the European jumps are at near sea level. So this will be an added challenge here in Park City with the top being at 7,000 feet. So it'll be quite challenging.
Yeah. Is this how you used to train?
I'm embarrassed to say that I was not much of an endurance athlete. I just like to go down the ski jump. But I'm really excited for this event to really get something unique for our community to do on top of the events we already host in Park City, but mostly use the Olympic venue for something other than ski jumping, bring awareness to the sport, to our club, and as well as Red Bull and Sarah Hendrickson, who is one of the athletes I work with the women's ski jumping team. She has done a phenomenal job the last years and unfortunately is injured right now coming back. But she'll be there on Saturday, as well as Olympic gold medalist Bill DeMong running. So be a lot of fun people to meet and a challenging, very challenging run.
All right. Make sure you stretch your Achilles. Tell us, how can people still participate?
They can, yeah. The latest number I heard, we're at 270 entries. The cap is 400. For race details, anybody can visit redbull400.com and follow the links there. And they'll get you signed up. We will also take sign-ups the day of. You can walk up and sign up if we're still able to take them. If we reach 400 people by Saturday, we won't do walk-up registration, but we will have staff to handle that if that happens. If there is a cap at 400, that will be announced on the website.
All right. So again, it's a fundraiser for the Park City Nordic Ski Club, and that's what, the both cross country and ski jumping.
That's
folks?
Correct. Yep, ski jumping and Nordic combined and cross country program. We've been growing tremendously over the last years, and having more of a community awareness, and we really want to let people know that our programs are there and what they offer. We really pride ourselves on confidence, courage, and character. And if anybody's interested in the winter programs, they're up now on the Utah Olympic Legacy website, which is utaholympiclegacy.org. And click on sport, find Nordic, and they also offer fly freestyle up there, G-force bobsled. So we have a lot to offer. So if you don't want to run, simply come check it out. There's a lot going on with zip lines, tubing, and alpine slide, as well as ropes course. So we have a fun Saturday ahead.
Okay. Again, registration, $50 per person. They can register at redbull400.com. Alan,
correct.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.